The story you're about to enjoy is a factual tale, read to you from a fictional location. We believe.
Madam, a guest has dropped a note into the suggestion box. Shall I set it alight?
Oh, not just yet, Mr. Darling. Let's read the suggestion before we ignore it, shall we?
They claim that the skull Halloween decoration that sits atop the column on the veranda is out of season and too realistic. What utter twaddle.
That's because it is real. That's the skull of Mama Merivelle.
Oh, I do recall climbing up to place her there so many years ago. Was that at her children's behest?
Oh, Mama Merivelle never had any human children, darling. She was a dedicated animal mother and strict vegetarian. She wanted her skeleton to serve them both in her afterlife. Welcome to the Midnight Library, my dear guests. I'm your light-hearted librarian and humble host, Miranda Merrick. Please make yourselves comfortable as tonight's reading is about to begin. Those among you with a propensity to notice hands in both real life as well as their depiction in historical art may have gathered that they literally seem to hold a great deal of significance and power. As far back as 40,000 years ago, some of the first known artistic renderings made by early human hands actually depict human hands. These amazing artworks have been pristinely preserved by the cave systems in which they were discovered, in areas such as France, Spain, and Argentina. The unmistakable shape of the human hand, with its opposing thumb and mountain-shaped outline of the accompanying four digits, was created on the cave walls by two rather obvious techniques. The artist either placed their palm into the pigment they'd made and then touched the cave wall to create a positive handprint, or they would place their clean palm against the cave wall and splatter the paint over the back of their hand. Most probably, the pigment was blown from their mouth, covering the placed hand in order to create a kind of negative or outline of the hand on the cave wall when they took their painted hand away. These thoughtful markings of our early ancestors are still on display for visitors today. Through this rich history, it is clear that hands in both reality and art can convey almost an infinite amount of information. We can even speak with our hands by forming letters and phrases if need be. We see them in art, either attached to the body of the person shown, say, a holy man delivering a blessing, as well as depicted detached to denote symbolism, as one might see on a Victorian tombstone or card, for example, a lady's hand extending a key. We see them as instruments of healing, as in a laying on of hands, as well as the opposite when they deliver a punch or the twist of your neck. I mean the neck. They signal in secret and curse without language. They keep the rhythm of life. They write, work, make, feed, build, and they break, maim, deface, and destroy. They calm and pet and heal and help. They claw and they tear. They stifle and they kill. They also stay firmly in our memories. Who among us doesn't know what their mother or father's hands look like? They curse and they carry. They birth and they bury. There you are. Darling, I hated to disturb you in your den this morning, but we need to discuss entertainment for our guests. What took you so long?
I wasn't ignoring you, madam. I was deeply ensconced in an audiobook. Since we've made the leap into the world of Audible, I find it difficult to pry myself away. Do you know they offer exotic romance novels?
Mr. Darling, if we're going to inform our guests of the vast catalog of listening enjoyment that Audible has to offer, then yes, let's include that.
Dear guests, if you're looking for a new experience in audio entertainment and knowledge, now is the time to take advantage of the Midnight Library's free Audible offer. Simply visit audible.com/TML for the Midnight Library, or text the letters TML to 500-500 to get started with a free trial. Every month, members get one credit to pick any title, plus two Audible originals from a monthly selection. You'll have access to new bestsellers and celebrity memoirs, business, self-development and guided meditation programs, podcasts, A-list comedy, and access to daily news digests from the likes of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. And titles, once downloaded, become permanently yours. You can listen offline, anywhere, anytime, on any device. Plus, your monthly credits can be rolled over from month to month for up to a year. No one else has an offer like this.
So, if you're uncertain of just what you'd like, you could save your credits and then invest them in the binging of something special, like the A Discovery of Witches series.
I might suggest the Shifters Unbound series for the more adventurous among you. But rest assured, there is something for everyone. Go immediately to audible.com/TML or text TML to 500-500 to get started.
Anyone who has held the hand of a loved one or shaken hands to seal a deal or even landed a slap on a face that desperately needed resetting knows the power of their own hands. But what if there was power left in the hands of the dead? In times not all that long past, such was the belief of some who believed in the power of the dead. They believed a dead man's hand had the power to perform magic that a living man's hand could not. The root of this belief, as far as anyone can speculate, may have begun in ancient Babylon with the Code of Hammurabi, almost 1,800 years before the Common Era. Hammurabi was the powerful and wise sixth king of Babylon, which is now modern Iraq. Well known down through Eastern history for his authoritative governing style, he became even more well known worldwide when archaeologists unearthed his famed code in 1901, not quite 4,000 years later. The code, carved by human hands, it may as well be said, was engraved in cuneiform text on a 7.5-foot-tall stone pillar, which interestingly has a distinct finger-like appearance. The 282 laws described in the code spelled out for the people of the time the manner in which business should fairly be conducted and justice should fairly be dealt out. The laws were plainly written and addressed such things as land ownership, the fulfillment of contracts regarding marriage, and the trading of goods and services, and the punishment of those who might break these contracts or commit out-and-out fraud, harm or damage, or theft against another's person or property. So, if you were responsible for a dam that broke and flooded a farmer's field, causing the ruination of his crop, you must simply compensate him for the value of the crop he had lost. Sounds perfectly just, yes? If you were a wife who wished to divorce your husband and provided believable testimony that you were neglected or poorly treated, no guilt was borne upon you and you could leave the marriage and return to your father's home. Antiquated to say the least, but still fair. But if you somehow caused a person to lose his eye, your eye would then be poked out. Or should we say in? I'm uncertain of how eye poking works. If you broke the bone of another person, the same bone of yours would then be broken. There's little detail as to how this tit-for-tat justice would be carried out, whether it be in turn by the person whom you had harmed or a member of the court. But one way or another, your eye was coming out. If for any reason you had struck your father, your hand was hewn off. And if by chance you were found guilty of robbery, depending on the nature of what you had stolen, you may lose your hand, or you were put to death. Hammurabi's commandments of justice might seem a bit harsh to some of us today, although there are still some locations throughout the modern world where such punishments are still doled out. Within Hammurabi's code and the laws of many Eastern lands, as well as the European nations, the act of committing a crime, especially with one's hands, was of particular interest and offense when it came to the law. The mantra was simply known, "He who does not keep the peace shall lose his hand." Medieval Europe was known for this policy. The lopping off of hands served as an effective theft deterrent in two ways. If you were missing your hand, people weren't likely to trust you to be in the proximity of anything of value, and the hands themselves were often placed on display as a clear warning to anyone contemplating the lifestyle of the thief. With all these disembodied hands about, it didn't take long for delusive stories to begin to be attached to them. After all, I think we can admit that if we did see a hand all on its own, the first question that comes to mind is, whose hand is this? It was probably only natural to want to be the one who could tell the tale, be it true or not. Severed hands were said to be cursed. They were said to move or even point. They were said to have power. What kind of power? Well, the power of will, of fate, of divination. Power over people and their possessions. One such documented tale comes from a very old pub in Wiltshire, England. The pub, charmingly named the Haunch of Venison, was built in 1335 and was at one point the scene of a dust-up over the accusations of cheating at cards. The guilty gambler's hand was judiciously detached by the pub's own butcher, who had sprung into action with his trusty meat cleaver. Having severed the reprehensible hand, he then flung it into the enormous fireplace. There, the offensive hand lay behind the bricks until it was discovered in 1911 by some workmen doing some renovations. The withered, ghoulish find was then placed inside a locked glass case with a deck of antique playing cards and placed on display for the patrons to admire, right up until the day it was stolen in 2010. No doubt by someone who still believes it has power. In 1905, another lonesome hand was found by workers doing demolition work in the town of North Rhine-Westphalia. This hacked-off hand was strangely encased in limestone and was known to the locals as the perjury hand, one that had been uncoupled from its owner as punishment for lying under oath. This hand, too, was on display for public viewing, right up until the day it was stolen in 2012. There's something so oddly appealing to me about envisioning hands stealing hands. Oh, as dark as all of this is, with the chopping off of hands and then people embellishing grim stories about them, let me assure you, it gets worse. There are a myriad of fiendish folklore tales surrounding severed hands, one involving unborn babies' hands that even I will not repeat. But the dark lore is as follows. If you wanted the most powerful of dead man's hands, a so-called hand of glory, certain choices and special steps would be needed to ensure your helping hand had power. First, you must choose the right kind of hand. Don't expect that swiping your granny's withered old chicken foot-looking hand would be of any use. You would need to find and cut loose the hand of a criminal that had just been hanged. The hand should be held upright by the fingertips so that any and all running blood could be squeezed from it. It would then be wrapped in shroud material and stuffed into a clay pot and packed with herbs, salts, and sometimes waxes and oils. After a fortnight of stewing in the thick mix, the hand should be unwrapped and allowed to bake in the noonday sun of the dog days until it is bone dry. If you had no son but remained determined, the hand could be baked dry in an oven with a sprinkling of fern and vervain sage. Yum. Now the tricky bit. Your prepared hand is rumored to hold within it several powers you'll no doubt wish to employ, especially if you're up to no good, which apparently many people were in times long ago. The Hand of Glory is said to be able to stop anyone dead in their tracks the moment it is presented to them. To make this feature work, the fingers of the hand must be set alight. And according to age-old superstition, this requires the fat of the dead man the hand was initially cut from. So, always plan ahead is the lesson here, I suppose. The Hand of Glory could not only freeze a person stock still, it was said that it could unlock any lock and cast a spell over any sleeping person so effectively that they could not be awakened by any means, be it shouting or shaking them. On a moonless night on a lonely moor between two very distant towns, a single inn was the only hope of shelter for the travelers that made their way along the only road. Nearing nightfall, a frail knock was heard at the door, and the inn's maid was sent to answer it. There, shivering in the damp night air, was a smallish poor man who said he had no money for a room, but only asked to sleep on the floor near the fire. The innkeeper and his wife had pity on the man and granted him his meager spot on the condition that he should depart before the other guests awoke at dawn. He thanked them with sincerity and promised to leave before anyone saw him, then took up his spot on the floor. Everyone in the house retired to their beds, except for the maid, who felt uneasy about the strange little man. She kept her eyes on him from her bunk near the kitchen. Once the house was quiet, the little man sat up in front of the fire and pulled from his clammy pocket a stiff gray hand. He placed it knowingly on the floor, upright on its wrist, and began slathering the still fingers with some manner of ointment he pulled from his other pocket. The maid watched in disbelief as the man took a match from the hearth and lit each finger alight, saying, "Let all those who are asleep be asleep, and let those who are awake be awake." As he did this, one of the fingers refused to hold a flame, but the little man looked about him, pulled a sack from his jacket, and began filling it with all of the room's valuable goods. The alarmed maid sneaked up the back passage to awaken the male servants, but they could not be woken. In fact, no matter how she pleaded and shook any of the sleepers, none of them came to. She dashed down the stairs, took up the flaming hand, and blew out the candle-like fingers, which all immediately relighted. The small man fled out the door with all he could carry as the maid doused the hand into the cat's bowl of milk. The moment the flames went out, the entire household was awakened. The men of the house chased the heavily laden little thief out onto the moor and easily caught him. He was hanged the next day from a tall oak tree on the edge of the moor, and his hands were stolen. It may interest you to know, my dear guests, and I feel by now I can share this with you, that my own name, Merrick, comes down from the Anglo-Saxon word merak, meaning boundary oak. Merak is also associated with a southern Scottish mountain range, referred to as the Range of the Awful Hand, or even those of the Sinister Hand. Perhaps you'll bear this in mind, as you no doubt count me as your friend. Do be careful on your way out. Good night, my lovelies.
Shall I remove Mama Merivale's skull, madam?
Absolutely not, darling. It was the woman's dying wish, and a pretty pair of blackbirds has passed through her eye sockets 100 times to build their nest. If you peer out from the seance room window, you can just glimpse their eggs through her nasal cavity.
Well, we don't dare tell that truth. They'll have us investigated. We'll say it comes down when we rebuild the veranda, for which we'll need a permit from the village council, and they all know how futile that is.
Good thinking, Mr. Darling. If they couldn't handle her skull being a birdhouse, I'm sure they wouldn't like to know that her bony hands are now salad tongs and her pelvis is a fruit bowl.
Shh.
The Midnight Library is co-produced by Tess Feifel and Astonishing Legends Productions and is edited by Sarah Voorhees-Wendell with music and sound design by Ryan McCullough. Special thanks to Miranda Merrick and Mr. Darling. No part of the show may be reproduced in any manner without express written consent. Copyright Astonishing Legends, all rights reserved.